work. You can't Google these lessons. They won't get you here. GraceBibleChurch.org. All one word. Gets you to the homepage. And at that page, there's a link called Learning. If you click on that Learning, it'll get you to all of the Sunday school classes. So you can get this one or any other one that you want to. You might find something else you want to listen to out there. So GraceBibleChurch.org will get you to the homepage, and you can navigate from there to get these lessons if you miss one and you want one. All right, let's stare at this chart for a few minutes before we crank up. You don't have this in your handout, but you have it if you were with us before, because it was in the handout last time we did our survey of eschatology. Was in there. And it's just a timeline-based chart that just kind of shows where different things happened in Israel's history as we go down through time. And we basically are going to be working along about right in through here. Now, if you notice on the chart, it follows a period of time known as the Judges, and Ruth follows in there as well. The period of Judges in Israel's history is probably the worst of Israel's history. It was a miserable time for them. God had redeemed them from Exodus and at the Exodus and brought them down into the Promised Land, and things kind of got going okay under Joshua. It wasn't ideal, but it was okay. But Joshua died off along about and through here. And what was left of the nation at that time was just sort of a tribal organization. There was no central government of any kind. There was no monarchy of any kind. It was just 12 different tribes, and they all kind of did what they wanted to. They were supposed to all be following God. He said he would lead them and guide them and provide for them and all that stuff, but they didn't. They disobeyed him. And so they started to disintegrate and fall apart. Now, he had established a principle with them earlier on back in Deuteronomy chapter 28, and that principle is basically this. If you will obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you will obey the Lord your God. So how would you summarize that offer? Could you say that obedience brings blessings? Yeah, I think that's probably a good way to summarize that principle. But there's another part to the principle. Deuteronomy 28:15. But it shall come about, if you will not obey the Lord your God to observe all his commandments and his statutes, which I charge you today, this is Moses talking, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. And every one of the blessings listed in the first part of Deuteronomy 28 becomes a curse in the second part of Deuteronomy 28 if they disobey. So how would you summarize that principle? Disobedience brings judgment. Yeah. So let's put them together. Obedience brings blessings. Disobedience brings judgments. That's the principle of life that God established with his people back here when he brought them out of Egypt. So on down through this time frame here, that's the operating principle between God and men. Obedience brings blessings. Disobedience brings judgment. Well, guess what the nation Israel did? They disobeyed, didn't they? And life deteriorated in that nation badly during that time. Here's a few headlines that could have appeared on the Jerusalem Times during that era. Family feud leaves 69 brothers dead. Powerful government leader caught in love nest. Gang rape leads to victim's death and dismemberment. Now, these are not out today's paper. Now, this could have been back in that day. Girls at party kidnapped and forced to marry strangers. Woman judge says travelers no longer safe on highways. Those are all appropriate headlines for the condition of life in the nation Israel during the time period of the judges there. They were circling the drain. Morally, they were shot. Spiritually, they were shot. The priesthood was renting themselves out and selling themselves out as private priests to families with money and stuff like that. My goodness. And basically, the conclusion is that in those days, people did what was right in their own eyes. There was no king. There was no central government. There was no leadership for them to follow. And so they just did whatever they wanted to do. It was every man for himself.
Beg
your pardon? Sounds awful familiar, doesn't it? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. So things were not good. The situation before David comes onto the scene, he's not the first one coming onto the scene to help here, was bad. Several places in Judgment, the concluding verse in Judges chapter 21 is, verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So that the nation was drastically lacking in leadership. Just moral, sound political leadership. Not to mention the lacking in spiritual leadership. Totally lacking in spiritual leadership. So it was desperately in need. There was another time we've been studying fairly recently, didn't we, where the nation was in great need, needed a deliverer, needed somebody to step up and lead them out of the mess that they were in. Remember that back in the book of Exodus? Who was that leader? Yeah, it was Moses. How long did it take God to bring Moses on the scene and to prepare him to be that leader? 80 years. My gosh. That's almost my whole lifetime. Took a while, didn't it? But God's going to do the same thing here that he did back then. He's going to provide leadership for the nation, even though they were rebellious and disobedient. He nevertheless is going to provide that. But David is not the first guy that God provides. He's going to provide somebody else to get to David, to bridge from where they are to David. That guy is a guy named Samuel. He's going to be the last of the judges. See that era of the judges up there just before him? There was about 12 of them during that era, maybe one or two more depending on how important you want to say they are. And Samuel is going to be the last one of them. He's going to lead the nation both spiritually and sort of politically until David comes on the scene. And his life is going to impact David's quite a bit as well. So we'll begin by studying his life. We have these two books called 1 and 2 Samuel. The Hebrews only have one book called Samuel. They don't divide them in two like we do. The Septuagint, when it was translated about 200 or 300 years before Christ, it divided them into these two, but the Hebrews did not. They're just all one book to them. And we don't know exactly who wrote it. Samuel didn't write all of it for sure, because a lot of it takes place after his death, so he ain't the author of all of it. He might have helped with some of it. We don't know. But since he's sort of the prime character in these two books, he gets the label. He gets to be called the guy. So he's going to be who we see. Okay? So we're at about, 1,000 years before Christ, a little more maybe. About 400 years after the Exodus, let's say. The nation has deteriorated badly. There's no central government. There's no central leadership. It's fragmented. It's morally corrupt. It's spiritually corrupt. It's desperately in need of leadership. And God knows that, and he provides some. And that's the guy we're going to look at. So let's crank it up here at 1 Samuel chapter 1. I beg your pardon?
Chapter 1, right?
Yes. Okay. 1 Samuel chapter 1. We'll actually start at the beginning. We could start in the middle, but it'll make more sense if we start at the beginning. And we're introduced to a guy here, certain man from a hard to pronounce name, from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, the Ephraimite. So we're introduced to this guy, and you'll find in your handout some maps. There's a number of them in there. A lot of this book has to do with geography, and so there's a variety of maps included in there. One that's labeled page 4 kind of shows you where this guy is from. It's not terribly critical, but he's from right around in this area here. That hard-to-pronounce name is really just Ramah. So here's Jerusalem. There's where he's from. He's sort of in the central part of the country here, and his name is Elkanah. And he had two wives. Now, right off the bat, we might want to question the guy's sanity. But that's the way it is. He's got two wives. Now, polygamy was accepted in Scripture at times. It wasn't always immediately judged or something like that. But clearly, God's plan for mankind that is set forth back in the early chapters of Genesis is one man, one woman, united together for life. One plus one equals one is God's ideal pattern for marriage. Now, what happened was that when the family could not have children, and they were so important, that they oftentimes would, the husband would get another wife. If the first wife couldn't have children, he'd go get another one. Try again. Get him a younger model next time. That was a problem. And that's what this guy has done. He's got two wives. Their names were Hannah and Peninnah. Let me just ask you before we read any further, would you think there's possibly any trouble in this household of any kind? Is there any chance at all that this is not a perfectly harmonious household? And if that ain't bad enough, check this out. Peninnah had children and Hannah did not. Yikes.
Trouble in River City.
That's right. You can predict what's going to happen here, I think, without even going any further. Two wives, one of whom has children and the other one does not. I take it that Hannah is the older of the two and that Peninnah was sort of added after the fact. So Hannah is barren, but not Peninnah. She has children. So I think we can look for some problems. Hopefully they won't be too great. Hopefully these two ladies won't be slugging it out every day for whose turn it is to be with Elkanah, kind of like Jacob's wives. You remember where they were going? They were trying to trade for these plants that supposedly were some kind of a producer of children and whatnot. Hopefully it won't be that bad, but we can suspect that it ain't going to be great. So every year, this guy would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Now, Shiloh was where the tabernacle was located at this time. It's right here. Remember, it was mobile. It was a tent. Take it down, put it on carts, drag it around wherever you want it, set it up. So it moved around some, but for right now, it's right here. So his family goes from here up to here each year to worship at the tabernacle. Three times a year they were supposed to go, Passover, Pentecost, and tabernacles. And he's faithful and he's doing that. He may not be the wisest of men, but he appears to be a godly man and wants to go up there and worship each year. And the two sons of Eli is the high priest. And he's got two sons. They're named Hophni and Phinehas. We're priests to the Lord there. We'll learn a little bit about them as we go along here in a little bit. You won't be impressed. So the high priest is there, and he's got these two sons who are sort of his deputies, and they're working and operating out of the tabernacle area there in Shiloh. And when the day came when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had closed her womb. We'll come back to that in just a minute. Some of these sacrifices that were defined in the book of Leviticus involved a sharing of the offering between the priests and the offerer. That's how the priests ate. So what would happen is you go up there and you offer your sacrifice, and certain portions of it God took for himself. He took the fat, probably trying to keep it out of the diet of the people. But other portions of it, good portions, the offerer got to eat himself. And this guy, Elkanah, he shares that with his wives and his family and everything. And he clearly loves Hannah because he gives her twice what he gives Peninnah. And he gives Peninnah plenty to live on. There's nothing being shortchanged here. But he's trying to express his love for her, I guess, by giving her twice as much of the shared sacrifice as he gave the other woman. Why? Because the Lord had closed her womb. Now, most of the ladies in this class, I won't say all, but most, are probably through having children. But you may have daughters or granddaughters who need to know this. God controls the womb, ladies. God controls the affairs of men, and he controls the womb. If you have children, it's because God has enabled you to have children. Ruth 4:13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The Lord enabled her to conceive. You think it's just a normal physical process. You ovulate, you got a cycle going on, you know how things work in that regard. And if there's a male sperm present and the female egg is fertilized, there is a new life. But it doesn't always happen, does it? It didn't happen for Sarah that way, did it? She was only 90. When she had her first child. And Jacob's wives, you know, some of them had problems. Samuel's mother couldn't have a child. Hannah cannot conceive because the Lord had closed her womb. He is controlling that process, and she cannot conceive. So make sure your daughters and your granddaughters understand that if there is a conception, it is as a result of the Lord's enablement. And if you wonder how it is, he can predict ahead of time that it's going to be a boy. You better understand that he's controlling that process, because there's a 50-50 chance that it's a boy or a girl. The male's sperm has both female and male. Trying to think of the term. Yeah. Chromosomes, yeah, that's what I was trying to, couldn't pull up. So there's a 50-50 chance that it could be a male or female. So how do you know ahead of time it's going to be a male? How can God's spokesman, his prophets, and so on, tell somebody they're going to have a male child unless he controls that? Otherwise, it's just flip a coin. You don't know what you're going to get. But he does control it. So that's how it is determined. So if you want a boy and you get a girl, don't be upset. God gave you a girl, and vice versa. So Hannah is unfortunately the victim of that process, and she has no children. And her rival, verse 6, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. A second statement of the same thing. Now, Peninnah is a stinker. She has no compassion for Hannah, and she actually irritates her by throwing up in her face the fact that she, Peninnah, has children and Hannah does not. She pours salt in Hannah's open womb. Doesn't work too well for them, does it? We suspected there might be some problems here. And lo and behold, we're right. Trouble in River City in this household. So year after year, as often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her, so she wept and would not eat. So every year she goes through this up there at that place of sacrifice, and Peninnah just irritates the daylights out of her as much as she can. This could not be a fine, happy, harmonious household, could it, when you got the two wives acting like that toward one another. And Elkanah, he doesn't quite understand the female perspective on all this. Verse 8, well, her husband said to her, Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat and why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? Well, this guy obviously has a little bit of an elevated opinion of himself. He thinks that Hannah ought to be perfectly happy because he's such a wonderful guy that not having any children, who cares? Forget that. I have such a wonderful husband that I don't mind not having any children. This guy's kind of got his head in the clouds a little bit, doesn't he? He doesn't understand that Jewish women all wanted to be the mother of Messiah, or at least the ancestor of Messiah, if not the mother, the grandmother, or the great-grandmother, or whatever. They all wanted children. They wanted them badly. So his opinion of himself is a bit of an ego trip, and he doesn't understand her at all. So he's no help. He's not interceding on her behalf before God, or so it would appear, because he thinks, hey, I'm treating you better than any sons that you could possibly have would ever treat you, so why are you in this funk? So he doesn't understand. So she's kind of on her own. In this particular case, it's probably good. So, verse 9, Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorposts of the temple of the Lord. So he's kind of sitting there in a sort of an official position, the high priest is, outside the tabernacle somewhere. And she is going to go pray to the Lord. Verse 10, she greatly distressed, prayed to the Lord, and wept bitterly. And she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy maidservant and remember me and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son. Now, she didn't just ask for a child. She asked for a son. She needs an XY here, not an XX. So she's asking the Lord for a particular type of conception, not just a conception, a son. If you'll do that, then I will give him back to you all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come upon his head. Now, this is a pretty extreme offer or vow that Hannah is making here, isn't it? Remember, she's desperate for a child. But she says, if you'll give me a son, I'll give him back to you as a servant to you in the priesthood all the days of his life. He will be a Nazarite. We won't cut his hair. We'll do the various things that the Nazarite vow included. And I will give him back to you. Think she's going to keep a promise like that, as desperate as she is for a son? Well, it'll tell us something about her character, won't it? And we will be impressed with her character. So, it came about, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli was watching her mouth. He sees her sitting over there, not too far from where he is, and she's mouthing her prayer. Not audibly, it's not out loud, it's just, she's just moving her lips as though she was speaking, and he sees that. She was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. He sees this, and he doesn't hear anything, and he thinks, this woman is drunk. Look at her. Acting like she's speaking, but there's no sound coming out. So he comes to a bad conclusion about her and dumps on her, verse 14. Eli said to her, "How long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you." So he rebukes her, which is rather ironic that he rebukes her and what she's doing, and we'll see as we get a little further into his family history why that's ironic. But Aunt Hannah answered back in verse 15 and says, "No, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation." So she explains herself. She's saying, what you're seeing here is not the result of drunkenness, but it's the result of oppression, depression, sorrow, sadness, that she can't have a child, and so she has appealed to the Lord in this extraordinary way, and he sees and understands. So he answers her in verse 7 and says, "Well, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him." So she is told by Eli that she's going to have that son that she's asked for. He gives her the answer to her prayer ahead of time. So she says back, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So she perks up. Now, in order for Eli to make that statement that she is going to have a son, we have to have, obviously, the divine control of the conception process. Or it could have been a daughter. But it isn't going to be a daughter. It's going to be a son. And his name is going to be Samuel. But she now is very encouraged. She's happy. Her prayer has gone answered. She has the good sense and the good spiritual insight to take her problem to the right source. She's not going to a doctor to see if there's some kind of a birthing process problem here that could be addressed or something like that. She's going to the Lord, who she, I think, probably knows and understands, controls all of this, and has asked for his help. Is there ever a time when it is inappropriate to do that, to go to the Lord? Is that a good plan A? Yeah, Psalm 18:6. "In my distress, I called upon the Lord, and I cried to my God for help. I heard my voice out of his temple, and my cry for help before him came into his ears." The psalmist understood that that's the place to go. Psalm 18:6. Psalm 46, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble." So oftentimes we turn to almost any other source other than him when we should, of course, turn to him. That's Psalm 46. And in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, "Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Hannah illustrates the New Testament principle of Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, in her life. She's doing what Hebrews encourages us to do: approach the throne of grace, seeking God's help. And that's exactly what she did. And God heard her prayers, he answered her prayers, and he told her that through Eli, the priest there. So, things are looking up for Hannah, aren't they? So then they rose early in the morning, verse 19, and worshiped before the Lord and returned again to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah had relations with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And it came about in due time that Hannah had conceived, that she might give birth to a son. How did that happen? Just coincidence? 50-50 coincidence here? No, clearly God is in control of this stuff. So she has a son, as was prophesied to her by Eli, and she named him Samuel, because I have asked him of the Lord. Samuel means basically the name of God, so she has named him in effect after God as best that she could. Then the man Elkanah went up with all his household to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up. So the next cycle, the next time he goes up, she doesn't go, because she said to her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned. Then I will bring him that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever. So male Jewish children are usually weaned in about a 2 to 3 year window. So she's going to spend the first 2 to 3 years with this child, Samuel, and not take him up there to give him to the priesthood at such an early age. So she's going to keep him till he's weaned. How many times do you think the idea popped in her mind to, just don't go up at all? Forget that nonsense. I got my son. I ain't going to go give him away. I ain't going to put him in a priesthood where I don't see him again for the rest of his life. Of course, she'd see him maybe annually, that type of thing. You'd have to think she thought about that, wouldn't you? So she knows she's going to give him up in time, and he will be there forever. So Elkanah responds back to her, verse 23, and says, well, do whatever seems best to you. He doesn't appear to be having a great deal of ownership in this vow himself, does he? It's his son. He says, well, do whatever you want to do. Remain until you've weaned him, only may the Lord confirm his word. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she'd weaned him. Would be about 3 years. So here is a new character that has been introduced into this world at a time that the nation desperately, desperately needs leadership of any kind, but especially spiritual leadership. So here's a guy named Samuel, born of this very faithful and dedicated mother of his, who previously could not have children. So one would hope that maybe this is the start of some help for this badly needful nation. So, first 3 years, he stays with her. Then in verse 24, when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, and a three-year-old bull and one ephah flour, a jug of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, although the child was young. Now, he's going to be raised at the tabernacle in Shiloh, in the priesthood. This will be his home. He was born here, but he's going to be raised up here. Now, the priesthood is not in the business normally of raising children. That's not their job. Normally, the priests didn't even begin their ministries until they were 30-ish. But in this case, he's actually going to be trained and prepared as a from an infancy all the way up to adulthood in the tabernacle and priesthood environs there in Shiloh. So they bring their sacrifice, slaughtered a bull, and brought the boy to Eli, the high priest. And she said, O my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. She reminds Eli of who she is and his promise relayed through him to her that this boy would be born. For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition which I ask of him. So I have dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there. She kept her promise. She had the good spiritual insight to take her problem to the right source. That problem was solved by God's grace, and she kept her promise. No telling how the storyline would go if she had not, is it? If she had not done what she said she would do, who knows what would have come of this whole storyline involving Samuel. But his mother was faithful, she was true to her vow, and she does take him up there. Barren no more, the vow was kept, and there is a deliverer of the nation on the way. He doesn't know it yet, neither do they, but he's on the way. So Hannah writes a tune. She expresses her thanksgiving to God and her worship of him in a song. This is kind of common, and we see this in the Old Testament from time to time. Remember, Miriam wrote a song after the crossing of the Red Sea, praising God for all that he was doing for the nation back then and delivering them. Hannah's doing something similar here. She's going to stress several of God's characteristics here. I'll just highlight those for you, and you can kind of read the song for yourself if you want to. First of all, she stresses his strength in verse 1 there. My horn is exalted in the Lord. That's a symbol of strength. And so she praises God for his strength. Praises him for his holiness in verse 2. Praises him for his knowledge in verse 3. Praises him for his power in verses 4 through 8. And for his judgment in verses 9 through 10. So his strength, his holiness, his knowledge, his power, and his judgment are all attributes of God that Hannah emphasizes in her song of thanksgiving here.
Holiness, knowledge, power, and judgment.
There's other things she could have brought to bear, I'm sure, but she brings that. It's a word of praise for answered prayer. That's never inappropriate, is it? When the prayer team is through praying for your need and you have success, a little word of praise is very, very appropriate. Always appropriate to thank God for his answered prayer and for all of the blessings that he brings into our lives. And Hannah recognizes that and talks to that effect. I put in your handout a list of some of the more prominent women in Scripture. Hannah's one of them. This is page 5 in your handout. It's alphabetized, and so you just have to go down there and find her if you want to. But these are some of the more impressive women that get some press. Not every woman gets any press in Scripture. Sometimes they're just ignored, but sometimes not. But there's a list of some of the more prominent ones that you see in the Old Testament in particular, and Hannah's certainly on that list. She's an impressive lady, a faithful, godly lady, kept her promise and her vow. Don't make a promise if you're not going to keep it. It's better not to make it. Don't make it and break it. So she kept hers, and we now have a young man being trained in the priesthood that is actually going to play a major role in God's revitalizing and rejuvenating Israel from its lowest standpoint, from the worst years of their existence, to what's going to amount to some of the best years of their existence. So we will see, as we work our way on through this story, we'll see some incidents of significant victory, noble and impressive people, and we'll see some miserable failures also. As we work our way through this, and we're not quite into David's life in detail yet, but you can kind of start watching for this if you want. There's a statement that is made of David that he was a man after God's own heart. What does that mean? The Because if I remember right, David was an adulterer. He was a murderer. Is that God's heart? Does that manifest God's heart in those characteristics? What's it mean to be a man after God's own heart? Well, we'll see the development of that attribute or trait as we get into David's life later and move on along. So be watching for that as we go. Look for characteristics that you think maybe illustrate or explain what that means. And we will see it as we go. Well, let me see. We might be able to actually cover two. Let's go ahead and go ahead on here a little bit this morning. Verse 11 of 1 Samuel 1. Then Elkanah went to his home in Ramah, but the boy ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest. So that's his mentor, that's his trainer, that's his teacher in life, the high priest. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. Yikes, that's not good. The high priest, in whose care Samuel has just been placed, he's raised worthless sons. How good of a father is he? Something's not right there, is it? Is it always the parents' fault if the children turn out to be worthless?
Yes.
We have a vote for yes over here. Any votes for no over here? This is not a parent. This is not a parent talking here.
I'm kidding.
What has happened here that Eli, the high priest, his own sons, are worthless? And we'll see them as we go along a little more in their character. And that's not an incorrect statement, that's for sure. But it's into his care, into Eli's care, that Samuel has been placed. They did not know the Lord. These guys weren't even believers, his own sons, the high priest's sons. That's a horrible situation. One could ask, well, did he do all he could? Was it just the boys just wouldn't pay attention to him? Did they blow him off? Clearly, we don't enter into God's kingdom through association. We don't ride our parents' coattail into God's heaven. We have to believe on our own. We have to have the new birth ourselves. Regardless of parents or siblings or other associations we have in life, we have to come to know the Lord ourselves. These boys did not. And they were rather contemptuous of the things of God in their behavior. And the custom of the priests with the people, they didn't know the Lord or that. When any man was offering a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. Thus they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servants would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give the priest meat for roasting, as he will not take boiled meat from you, only raw." And if the man said to them, "Well, first we must surely boil the meat," he said, "Well, and then you can take as much as you're desiring." He said, "No, you'll give it to me now. If not, I'll take it by force." Thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, and the men despised the offering of the Lord. Now what's going on here is that there's a process for how these offerings were made. And the way they were offered is that God took his portion first, which was the fat, the stuff that people shouldn't be eating anyway, and then what was left over could be shared. And what these guys were doing, his sons were doing, is when a sacrifice was offered, they just came and took whatever they wanted of it. They paid no attention to the proper processing of these sacrifices and what it symbolized. They just took what they wanted. They basically spit on God's sacrificial process here. That's how worthless they are. It's how contemptuous they were of God's things. I got to think maybe things aren't going to work out real well for these two guys. It is a huge, huge mistake to stick your fist in God's face. Remember in the old, well, let's go into the New Testament first. John tells us in 1 John 5 that there is a sin for which intercessory prayer will have no value because God is going to bring about the death of that sinner and you cannot intervene on his behalf. It's called a sin unto death. And John says there's no point in praying for that. I want you to intercede for all other sins that don't lead to death, but that one, don't waste your time praying for it. Intercessory prayer ain't going to work. That's the prayer of the raised fist. That's sticking your fist in God's face and say, I don't care what you say. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. Intercessory prayer will not help that person. It's the only one that it won't help. But that's told to us in 1 John chapter 5. This looks like to me an instance of that sticking your fist in God's face, and there's no